Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. A special one-hour presentation, an in-depth, original investigation into how long does humanity have? A look at feedback loops, tipping points, best and worst case scenarios for our species. My guest, Professor Guy McPherson. Professor McPherson is a professor emeritus of Natural Sources, Resources, Ecology, and Evolutionary Biology, University of Arizona. He has specialized in forest resources, energy decline, and climate change, and its economic consequences. To try to enlighten by good science, by open and honest discussions, how bad the environment was becoming, he said enough, and he disengaged. And that's unfortunate, because after publishing peer-reviewed literature, speaking at important scientific symposia, we all live in a house on fire. No fire department to call, no way out, just the upstairs window to look at while the fire burns the house down with us trapped, locked in it. When I look at the environment today, I'm asking a simple question. Why is it that after 50 years of examining environmental sciences, we are at this place we are today, where only a few countries have made some effort, like Germany, to de-license and close down its nuclear power plants and replace them with solar, where there is a budding solar energy movement, but in all the major polluting countries of the world, the United States and China being the top two, India and Brazil right behind them. So if you have three or four countries doing a good and noble job, but you have the biggest polluters not doing anything, and let's be honest, we are not doing anything. Do not try to assuage our guilt of doing nothing by saying that we had a Paris conference or another conference in South America or one in Europe. These conferences are all the same. You have a large number of environmentalists. You have different environmental organizations, many of those environmental organizations receiving large amounts of money, some over hundreds of millions of dollars, from the very industries that are doing the polluting. And hence, those environmental organizations never bring up on their agendas how to stop the coal or the oil or the gas hydrofracking or whatever it is that they're receiving money from. Much of our environmental movement has been co-opted. Much of academia is either too dishonest in the pay of special interests that are in themselves polluters, or they are in that rotating system of going from the government back into industry, back into government. So the policymakers and the opinion leaders have, in my opinion, chosen to talk about the environment but not to actually do anything about it. I think it's rather hypocritical for Al Gore and others to fly on private jets, to have massive guzzling SUVs, and to look at the environment as a green financial capitalist opportunity and to exploit it as such. But where was Al Gore and so many other celebrities saying, let us go vegan, let us give up plastic, let us boycott and protest outside of factories that are polluting? That has not happened. It's very easy for Leonardo DiCaprio to be given an award by the Water Project, where he flies in on a private jet from the Cannes Film Festival, accepts it, and flies back. The hypocrisy is palpable. We have done nothing measurable to stop it. If you ask the average American, do you care about the weather? They'll say yes. Do you care about global warming? I'm not certain. In fact, about half of Americans don't believe that global warming is a big deal and or that humans are responsible. You could understand that when you see how much money is poured into advertising, promotion, think tanks, front groups, and spokespersons denying global warming or denying human input into it. They have a great deal of power within Congress, and now the new president is a global warming denialist, and the people he's put in charge of different agencies are also the same. So what I'm going to do is give you just facts. The information I'm about to share is completely documented. And this is why it's important to listen to what Professor McPherson will be sharing for the rest of the hour, because I noticed something years ago when I was working on a new book, my first book on the environment, Clearer, Cleaner, Safer, Greener, Blueprint for New Environment, and subsequent films on the environment, showed me a lesson. And that lesson was I could be interviewing an extraordinarily knowledgeable, dedicated environmentalist in some part of climate change, and that person would acknowledge that we have a problem. And that problem would be, let's say, with acidification of the ocean. And what that means, how with the coral reefs bleaching out, some in as little as 3 years, where they've been there for 100 million years, now they're gone, or substantially gone, including the Great Coral Reef of Australia, and millions upon hundreds of millions of little fish feed off those. It is home to them, no longer. And how when you warm the ocean too much, a lot of the creatures that use that as a habitat have to go to colder water in order to survive. If they go to colder water, the fish that feed off them have to go to colder water. And we've seen millions upon tens of millions, billions of dead fish, and hundreds of thousands of sea mammals, whales, orcas, dolphins, sea lions, dying in mass. And yet we have not been told the full truth. But that expert will give you as much knowledge as they have on that one exact topic. In Louisiana this year, recently, within the last 3 months, they had a once-in-500-year flooding. Over 67,000 homes were damaged or destroyed in just one parish. A parish is the same as a county. The whole state was adversely affected. Not just when they lost their homes and cannot go back into the homes because of mold and environmental issues, but because they had no insurance, because it never floods in most of the state. But it did. The trouble was we had seven separate once-in-500-year events in the last 12 months. We've had more than 12,000 what are called unique environmental happenings in the last year in the United States. Dust and sand storms, the largest ever recorded, as an example. And yet, if you were to ask the climatologists about the flooding in Louisiana, they could give you specific information. How severe was the flooding? How many inches and what period of time? How that had never happened before? The type and devastation that impacted people. These are pieces of the puzzle. If you ask someone about glacier melting in the Himalayas, that's a different expert than in the glaciers of Antarctica, which is different than Iceland, which is different than Canada, which is different than in other parts of the United States. Each one has staked out an area of specific concern. If you ask about the erosion of topsoil, acid rain, plastic that is not biodegradable, three times the size of Texas in the Western Pacific, they can all give you lots of insights. What is the problem with this is that each one has a piece of a puzzle, and that is not allowing us to see the totality of the problem and its likely outcome and adverse effects. Guy McPherson is one of only a handful of scientists that I know of who are willing to look at all the pieces, bring them together, and show the interlockingness of each one of these. Let me give you some of the major concerns, and then ask yourself, when did you ever hear all of these at the same time? From the Germans' Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research. New study shows Antarctic melting approaching unstoppable tipping points. As one example, there is currently about to break within the next week or two or so, there will be the Larsen Sea Shelf. It is the largest iceberg ever to break. It is 70 miles long, and it is 300 yards wide and very deep. Now, that's a big piece of ice to go into the ocean. And what's worse, it is what stops the glaciers from going further into the ocean. Now that will accelerate. And already, before they even mentioned the Larsen B shelf, they're saying it's unstoppable. This just makes it speed up all the more. From Climate News Network, the price to be paid for not cutting emissions of greenhouse gases could mean driving the planet across planetary boundaries or tipping points. From the Institute of Governance and Sustainable Development, the world already teetering on tipping points for abrupt climate change. From the World Glacier Monitoring Service, the University of Zurich, global glaciers melting at 300% the rate faster than the 20th century. From the Chinese government's official environmental agency, Chinese glaciers retreat signals trouble for Asian water supplies. And by the way, we're talking about the entire Himalayas. We're talking about rivers that come from the Himalayas that feed India its water, and China its water, even the Mekong Delta. All of these, the Yellow River, they all are coming from the same sources, and now those are melting. From the World Meteorological Organization, alarming year of extremes as climate tipping point looms. From the American Geophysical Union, West Antarctic ice shelf breaking up from the inside out. Researchers trace the origins of a 2015 iceberg to crack that formed deep beneath the ice. University of California, Santa Cruz, strong geothermal heating measured beneath West Antarctic ice sheet, which means that there is heat coming from underneath and heat above. From the American Geophysical Union, surge in methane emissions threatens efforts to slow climate change. From Harvard University, methane spewing U.S. linked to global surge in potent greenhouse gas. They're referring to the methane from the ocean, as well as methane from previously frozen tundras, like the Great Boreal Forest and Siberia and Arctic, which has held enormous quantities of methane frozen. Now those areas are thawing and the methane is being released. From the Commonwealth Scientific Industrial Research Organization, Australia, this melting glacier in Antarctica could raise sea levels by 11 feet. European Center for Geoscience Research. Climate change could flip the Mediterranean lands into desert. University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Scientists are clear. Big winter storms influenced by warming planet. Princeton University Engineering School. Giant Middle East dust storm caused by changing climate, not human conflict. And it covers seven states. By the way, that is the largest dust storm ever measured in world history, covering seven states, a huge dust storm. University of Chicago, Dust Bowl will obliterate modern crops. We're talking about Dust Bowl now, not the future, dwarfing anything that we saw in the Great Dust Bowls of the 1930s. From Rutgers University, New York City can expect more than 9-foot floods. From the Daily Mail, almost biblical, amazing 3,000-foot-high dust storm shrouds Phoenix. 3,000-foot-high, 30 miles wide, blankets Phoenix. That's the largest dust storm ever recorded in the United States. What they did not mention is that it also contained sand. It was a sand and dust storm, the kind of sandstorm you find in the Arabian Desert, not in Arizona. And imagine what that sand does to crops. It destroys them. And to seedlings, to bees, to pollinators, to the quality of sprouts coming out of the soil, to buds of fruit trees. It devastates all of it. From the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, unprecedented mass die-offs as Pacific Ocean turning into a desert off California coast. From NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, California is turning back into a desert, and there are no contingency plans. As an aside, and one last one, is University of Georgia, U.S. faces floods of climate refugees. Not Africa, that has its own 160 million plus climate refugees, Europe will have its refugees. The Mediterranean will be turning into a desert. This is refugees in the United States, when people no longer can stay on the land because it is no longer fertile. The topsoil has been eroded. Decade after decade of using monocrops, a single crop, soybeans, cotton, genetically engineered, using pesticides like Roundup and glyphosate, the very toxic chemical that is the most commonly used pesticide in the world, nitrogen fertilizers, where in the wintertime there is no cover crop. As a result, when the land freezes and the snow accumulates in the spring, when the snow melts, it takes the topsoil with it because there's nothing holding it in place. There is no vital structure, and it washes it into the rivers. And then all that pollution, all that nitrogen goes down and creates dead zones in the Mississippi and into the Gulf. The largest, when I was down there filming recently, I saw a dead zone in the Gulf at the mouth of the Mississippi, larger than the state of New Jersey. And that's one of over 400 dead zones. And they're increasing. Now one day you wake up and you can't plant anything. It's too hot, it's too wet, or there's not enough soil. And so you move on. And we're seeing that now. That is my introduction. Before I get into the tipping points, let's go over now and say hello to my guest, Imba Lees, standing by, Professor McPherson. Nice to have you with us today, Guy.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be with you today.
We have a very poor connection, but I feel this is some of the things you're going to be sharing with us is very important. Guy and I'm sorry for the poor technical quality, but when you're in the jungle and we this is the only time we have on this, I'm going to ask you a question. Did you recently state that based upon all of the tipping points and all the feedback, loose, both positive and negative, that from your perspective, you felt that civilization as we know it, as we're living it today, would begin to disintegrate or cease in its current form within the next 10 years?
Yes, I think it's far worse than that. I can't imagine there will be a human being on the planet 10 years from today. I think civilization is on its way out much sooner, and I can elaborate on that if you'd like.
Yes, we just got a little better connection. We've switched it back to Skype, so that's good. Then lay out your argument and try to be as specific as possible on supporting your hypothesis.
Of course. It appears that we are headed for an ice-free Arctic. The Arctic Ocean has not been ice-free during the span of humans on the planet. This is truly unprecedented, and it could happen this summer. An analysis completed by the U.S. Naval Postgraduate College indicated that the Arctic would be ice-free. That was their prediction in 2016, plus or minus 3 years. I think we've dodged a bullet at least four times, and it would surprise me if we didn't have an ice-free Arctic this summer or next summer, 2017 or 2018. When that happens, I don't see any way to avoid the prediction made by Natalia Shikoh and colleagues at the European Geophysical Union meetings in 2008. That prediction involves a 50 gigaton burst of methane arising out of the shallow seabed of the Arctic Ocean, triggering a 1.3 degrees Celsius global average temperature rise. We tack that on to the approximately 1.6 degrees above baseline that the planet finds itself at right now, and that takes us well beyond the temperature globally that has supported humans in the past. It's difficult for me to imagine civilization persists at approximately 3 degrees Celsius above baseline with a little over a third of that temperature rise coming span of a few weeks or a few months, as predicted by Natalia Shikova, Igor Samelatov, and colleagues at that European Geophysical Union meeting. That's just civilization. There's more.
Please continue.
Once civilization collapses, goes away, declines, reaches its overdue end, whatever you call it, And this civilization, like all others, depends upon the ability to grow and store grains. Once we get to about 3 degrees Celsius above baseline, higher than the temperature that has supported humans on this planet in the past, it's hard for me to imagine, and I think almost any mainstream climate scientist would support the notion that anything above 2 degrees Celsius above baseline takes beyond the ability to grow grains at scale. That happens, we experience a lack of global dimming, and that is going to be responsible for about 3 degrees Celsius additional global average temperature rise in a very short period of time. Global dimming results from burning fossil fuels that put particulates into the atmosphere, most notably sulfates associated with burning, quote, low-quality coal. Those sulfates serve as an umbrella over the planet. They go up into the atmosphere and they reflect incoming sunlight and keep Earth cooler than it would be otherwise if we hadn't burned that low-quality coal and put the sulfates up into the atmosphere. So we're in quite the paradox here. Civilization itself is a heat engine. We burn those fossil fuels. It produces the greenhouse effect, holds the heat close to the planet. And at the same time, burning fossil fuels puts aerosols into the atmosphere that protects us. And the global average temperature rise associated with the falling out of the sky of those sulfates will be truly catastrophic for our species. That could happen in as little as 18 months. I can't even imagine we could have an ice free Arctic by 2019, the far end of the range predicted by the U.S. Naval Postgraduate College. And so it's difficult for me to imagine we would have habitat for our favorite species 5 years out from now.
Explain what it is in the way of these most devastating consequences to feedback loops that begin to cause food not to be grown or water supplies not to be available, drinking water supplies, which right now only 1% of the world's water can actually be consumed. We have 1.2 billion people who right now do not have access to clean drinking water. And then what happens to a city like New York or Chicago or Shanghai or other cities around the world? And what happens to all those cities? For example, Egypt has no natural water supply at all. It's relying upon other countries, allowing the Nile to flow freely so it gets its water. And we're already seeing desertification in China and in other countries. Explain your perspective on those phenomena.
You hinted at it when you started this program with that rundown of headlines and short synopses from various organizations and media outlets. We are already seeing a situation that is as bad and is certainly going to get worse than the Great Dust Bowl of the United States during the 1930s. Timothy Egan wrote a book about that event called The Worst Hard Time. It came out about 10 years ago. He wanted to capture the opinions and experiences of the people still alive who survived the Dust Bowl of the 1930s. And so he worked hard to write this book. Well, I refer to that book as the second worst hard time. The worst hard time is still in front of us, and it looks like it's being manifest faster than expected. We are already seeing Dust Bowl-type conditions all over the interior of large continents in the Northern Hemisphere. That's because the interior of large continents heats up at least twice as fast as the global average. So we're at about a degree and a half Celsius above baseline for the global average. What that means is we're at or higher than 3 degrees Celsius above the 1750 baseline for the interior of large continents. That's where we grow the grains. Once we get that kind of high temperature, which produces instability in the climate system, then we have floods like you talked about occurring in Texas, the likes of which Texas has never seen. We get the drought that you talked about that is popping up all over the world. We get the 3,000-foot-tall dust storm in Phoenix, Arizona. We have all of these indications of an unstable climate system manifesting at the same time, as you indicate, thousands of them over the course of the last year. Unusual events are in the headlines every day now with respect to weather. Connecting the dots on those, I don't see us able to grow the food we've been able to grow at scale simply because the weather becomes too unstable to do so. Civilizations arose to begin with 6 or 7 times around the globe, pretty much simultaneously, because Earth came out of an ice age, warmed slightly, about 1.5 degrees above the ice age, and then the temperature stabilized globally. And once it had stabilized for a few thousand years, civilizations popped up pretty much simultaneously all over the globe. Was because the slightly warmer than ice age conditions and stable climatic conditions. We now have produced a situation in which we no longer have stable climatic conditions around the globe, and nowhere is this more evident than in the interior of large continents, especially in the northern hemisphere. So places like Siberia, where the permafrost has become permamelt. Yesterday's headline from Siberia indicates a massive landslide as a result of permafrost melting. We have the Dust Bowl you talked about that is here already and is being exacerbated every year. We have those tremendous floods you described. The list goes on. The weather is unstable because the climate is unstable. And therefore, the ability to grow grains is threatened. Grains form the basis for every civilization so far, including this one. It's not just about the digits on the computer screen. It's about the ability to grow and store food. As Daniel Quinn described in his book Ishmael and many other books, civilization is best described with 5 words. They lock up the food. We can only do that with food that can be stored. Food that can be stored best at scale is grains, things like wheat, corn, oats, and so on. And when the ability to grow and store that food is threatened, we're talking about the collapse of civilization in a relatively short period of time, and then very quickly thereafter, the instability of the climate system that has supported our own existence on this planet disappearing in a very short period of time. This is horrible news. I'm not happy to present it. I'm not a proponent of the decline of our species. I'm just reporting the news and connecting the dots where it goes from my perspective as a conservation biologist.
It was George Bernard Shaw and Major Barbara who said, "Hatred is the coward's revenge for being intimidated." And right now you have a massive amount of people within the media, in the body politic, in front organizations who are saying these are just scare tactics, and we, and when I refer to we, we're referring to a relatively small group of individuals. You're not alone, as you know, Guy. There is also Paul Beckwith, University of Ottawa. There's Jason Box at the Geological Survey of Denmark. There's Tim Garrier, University of Utah. There's Natalia Sokova, University of Alaska. There's Brendan Gleeson, University of Ireland. And more moderately would be James Hansen, formerly of NASA. He was just, for all intents and purposes, he was no longer considered good news or interesting conversation to many people when he started predicting some very dire consequences. They didn't want to hear this. Michael Mann, Columbia University, Henry Pollack, University of Michigan, David Orr, Oberlin College. So there's, when you think of the thousands of climate scientists and you think that you can name 10, maybe a few more, who are willing to put the pieces together, look at it synergistically, and just simply tell the truth. That's a truth that the media won't tolerate. That's where you'll be attacked for this. And yet, look at the world without, like the Buddha, go to neutral, detach from the outcome, and simply look at every single one of the events that are happening now. Every single day, I look over special websites to all the actual meteorological and weather phenomena on a daily basis. It is inevitable you're going to have some of these catastrophes happen very quickly, and yet people will not move. They will not. In fact, even today, there was an article in the New York Times, I believe, talking about how the builders on the water in New York or in Manhattan are now planning on building buildings taller. Well, that doesn't stop the ocean from coming in. It doesn't stop the subway system where we have our subways and our power grids and our gas and our water mains from being flooded and unusable. We had a little tiny tap on the wrist with Hurricane Sandy, and look at the devastation, look at the death, the destruction of homes, how it brought New York City to a standstill. Interesting, because on my sister station, WBI, where I've been daily for 40 years, I had asked that all day that day and up till 7 o'clock, come uptown because you're going to be knocked off the air. No, we won't. Until my last call, they were so irritated, they told me to stop calling them. An hour later, they were off the air. 4 hours later, the water was up to and above the traffic light at the Wall Street building where they're at. Now, they weren't flooded upstairs, but then they had to come up the next day. Even people who should be aware, who should have enough insight to know what's happening, if they're afraid of the truth, they're not going to do anything, and therefore they're angry at you for telling them a truth that they're not willing to acknowledge. So what I want to do now, Paul, I want to take just a few minutes and talk about some of the tipping points and then ask you to go into a little more detail on them, all right? Here are the things that are happening around the world. I'm trying to give everyone the larger, broader, more inclusive Gaia picture. Guy mentioned melting of the Arctic ice cap. That is a tipping point that we're already way past. Nothing can be done to stop it. Greenland is becoming ice-free. That could raise the level of the water in the oceans by 20 feet. And understand, it doesn't happen all at once. What most of the climatologists and politicians are doing, they're looking at best-case scenario in the future. And we're saying before you get to the worst-case scenario, you have a lot leading up to it. It's like a person dying of cancer. They just don't wake up one day, diagnosed with cancer, and then die that night. It can go on for years. Same thing with heart disease. It takes time, and all that time is a negative consequence. So disintegration of the West Antarctic ice sheet, that's happening as we speak, and just that West Antarctic ice sheet could raise the water by 16 feet over how long a period of time, no one can accurately predict. The loss of glaciers, the loss of the albedo, and the rise of sea levels. The fresh water from Arctic and Greenland collapsing the Gulf Stream. That's where warm water is taken from South America and the Caribbean up through the Arctic, and then back down comes cool water. This loop, and when that loop has been adversely affected and slows down or stops, then you have really a catastrophe in all of Europe when it comes to their temperature. It's possible with the tipping points that El Nino becomes a permanent climate fixture. The disruption of the Indian West African monsoons, because hundreds of millions, actually more than, it's over a billion people, rely upon the monsoons for their crops to grow. Well, what if the monsoons don't stop? And what if they never come? This is possible. The melting permafrost that Guy mentioned and the tundra releasing vast quantities of methane, the clathrate, gum effect, the desertification. I found in one environmental news report, but nowhere in the media, that in China alone, in the last 10 years, they've lost over 26,000 communities to the desert. 50% of all their rivers are dried up and no longer are providing any water whatsoever. And of the remaining water, over 90% of all the water in China is undrinkable. It's not even safe enough to be used in irrigation, yet they do it anyhow. That is the consequence of making all your energy into modernization, none into environmental. You also have the Arctic ozone hole, the loss of the rainforest, especially the Amazon. I've been telling people since 1972 that we're losing anywhere from 50 to 100 acres per minute in the Amazon. That's where the soybeans, genetically engineered, are being grown, but they're taking down enormous amount of trees per day that have almost no topsoil. Remember, when you grow in the Amazon, you're dealing with 1 to 2 inches of topsoil, and yet they're destroying all the trees there, putting in corn, putting in soy. 1 or 2 years is gone, then it's a desert. And you'll see this in my new documentary where flying over the Amazon just above the treetops, where the Amazon used to have villages right on it, where a person would have a boat right on the Amazon. Now it's 200 yards back. You had the loss of the boreal forest. And by the way, that's one of the more recent tipping point additions. And then you have what are called positive feedback loops that exacerbate climate change. Don't confuse or conflate positive with something good. In this case, positive is actually negative. A positive feedback loop is something that forces the system itself, the effects of it, which then causes the system to go further or faster in the direction it was pushed by the initial force. So once you start the melting of a glacier, the more heat from underneath, like volcanics underneath, and then the sun on top, and then the combination of the two, once they start melting, it begins to accelerate that nothing can stop it. And that's what we have. And also you have the forest and the grasslands and the peat are drying up and burning. And when they burn, they're releasing CO2, which causes more heat. We're weakening ecology. We're getting more pests. They're creating more disease and releasing more methane. Over 100 million trees have died in California alone. Yet you don't see that advertised anywhere in any commercial. Come to California, we won't have any trees left. And unless it's Barbara Streisand's backyard. But the trees are dying. But that's also true. Guy, once a year I go on my own personal, private, spiritual quest. I go someplace for a week. I fast, drink water, nothing else. Stay out of nature and rebalance myself. The last time I went up to Arizona, flew into Phoenix, drove up that about 3 hours to Flagstaff and above. And in between the two is Sedona, beautiful area. And it turns out that while I was having some lunch, the mayor comes over the ex-mayor and says, you know, he wanted to take me on a little tour, so I went on a little tour. And I asked him about the water. He said, oh, we're in a terrible situation with water, terrible. We have half the water that we need, and it's getting worse. Well, when I drove on up to Flagstaff, where I was going to meditate, there are photographs of me meditating up in the nature in the woods, and you see fires all around, huge fires. And I drove through areas where thousands of acres have been burned. Now, traditionally, people from Phoenix would go to Flagstaff in the woods above that because of its coolness. Not now. Now, everything is burning. It's also true in Wyoming, Montana, and they're burning. And people have to understand that, but they don't focus on it. We've got soil erosion at a massive level. It's being washed away with increasingly extreme storms and flooding, leaving no medium for plants to absorb CO2. We have terrestrial soils drying up and releasing CO2 and methane. And by the way, just as a statistic, if the bank of carbon held in the world's soils were to drop just 0.3%, again, that's 0.3%, the release would equal a year's worth of fossil fuel emissions. And permafrost melts release CO2 and methane from new bacterial activity. And freely released methane from deeper reservoirs starts to release carbon rather than absorbing carbon. When you have trees and grasses and shrubs, they absorb carbon. That's a good thing. When you take away the trees and the grasses, that releases carbon. That's a bad thing. And extreme weather feedback loops, there's combinations. Extreme weather leads to less CO2 absorption and more warming, and seabeds permafrost, the clathrates, and that frees up methane. By the way, so you understand, a clathrate is equal to crystalline water-based solids physically resembling ice, in which small nonpolar molecules, typically gases, are trapped inside these what are called cages of hydrogen-bonded and frozen water molecules. You also have warming sea surfaces, increasing the methogens, which are bacteria that release methane. You have new flooded areas from sea level rise that turns the area bad because the salt water comes in and goes into the aquifers. And as atmospheric humidity increases with global warming, the amount of high troposphere ice particles increase, and these ice particles reduce the rate of methane oxidation. And this implies that with rising global temperatures, the global warming potential of the methane in the atmosphere over the Arctic will increase. And we cannot handle any of this because warming oceans absorb less CO2. And warmer oceans kill off planktons, phytoplanktons, that otherwise sequester CO2. So then you're going to end up with droughts. And Guy mentioned droughts. Where are you going to get your food? Well, initially, the people who are the wealthiest nations, who have the most money, will be able to get it from other countries. But what happens when your country, when your major breadbasket, runs out of water from the Akalaka, the largest aquifer in America, one of the largest in the world, where you no longer have water to irrigate crops, even if you have topsoil to grow seeds in? So now you're running out of water. It's over 50% down. And major cities are running out of water. Communities are running out of clean drinking water. And wells are drying up. And now you have droughts so bad that the seeds can't germinate. But if you're sitting in an office building, or you're on a campus at Harvard or Yale, if you're working in a skyscraper, and you look out and you see nothing but niceness, it's hard to imagine this is occurring because you're not seeing it. The media is not presenting it. And so the end of a change of state, when all ice is gone in a region, no more heat is sucked up by its melting. So you got newly opened Arctic Ocean evaporating, more water, a greenhouse gas, but an open ocean can also absorb more CO2. And so you have more forest fires, more loss of land, more drying up of water, worse storms than ever before, and nothing is being done. That's going to start more wars. It's going to make more people stay in denial. It'll start some crazy ideas of geoengineering. And we're going to see, I think, all this starting now. Your thoughts on this?
Yes, absolutely. And I'd like to point out that among the two handfuls of people you mentioned, one that was conspicuous by his absence, that's Peter Wadhams, formerly director of the Ocean Physics Program at Cambridge University, and forced into retirement because he was presenting evidence regarding the Arctic ice. According to his calculations from 2012, the loss of albedo alone from the Arctic ice, never mind the methane release, just loss of albedo alone, or loss of reflectance as that ice goes away, well, it's already increased the global heat absorption, the global energy absorption of the planet from 0.43 watts per square meter through the early 1990s up to about 0.75 watts per square meter from the 1990s, and he predicts it'll be more than 2 watts per square meter. That's at the global level. And so he was forced into retirement from Cambridge University and now works at a smaller college in Ireland. He also indicated to me via email correspondence that I'm being too conservative, that my connecting the dots with respect to these self-reinforcing feedback loops or so-called positive feedbacks that, as you indicated, are not really positive, that my approach was too conservative. I was simply adding together the 1.6 degrees Celsius that he comes up with from lack of albedo and adding that together with about 1.1 degrees C from methane release, a very conservative number, and so on. And he says it's far worse than that. Taking the conservative approach, you should be multiplying those together, not simply adding them together. So here's another case of even the very conservative approach taken by me and other climate scientists leading to disparagement and, in his case, loss of a very privileged position at Cambridge University because he was connecting a few dots. It's truly horrible. No mainstream scientist can actually connect the dots and remain supported in his or her job. Now, I'm not saying they're all going to lose their jobs. I'm just indicating that they're going to lose support for their jobs. And that's why Jason Box left Ohio State University because he was censored. That's why Camille Parmesan left the University of Texas to go to London because she was censored. That's why I left the University of Arizona more than 7 years ago, because I was heavily censored. Peter Wadhams is an exceptional case in that he was actually forced into retirement. He wasn't being censored and then took the active choice of leaving. He was actually forced out. So when we put together this information about these self-reinforcing feedback loops, it paints a truly dire picture for our species, never mind the continuation of this set of living arrangements, but for our species and for so many other species that are being driven to extinction by the actions of, quote, civilized society. Already, for example, we know based on a United Nations report from August 2010 that we are driving to extinction some 150 to 200 species every day. That's the estimate. That's a lot of species going over the edge. And it shouldn't surprise us too terribly that if our actions caused that had to happen every single day and we don't take action to reverse direction, then indeed we will end up in the direction we're headed.
Guy, would you once again give us what you realistically, from your perspective, and this is your hypothesis, give us what you believe the timeline is for starting to see the various components of society in different countries begin to end?
I think it's already underway, Gary. I think the headlines you read at the top of the hour tell us the story for anybody who's willing to listen. I think that we are seeing Dust Bowl-like conditions manifest already. I think we're seeing a lack of potable water for millions, perhaps billions of people around the globe. I think we're seeing food insecurity already presenting itself in the less wealthy countries around the planet. This is already underway. It's going to get worse. There's approximately a 10-year lag between emission of carbon dioxide and maximum heating associated with the carbon dioxide molecules. It's going to get worse. There is no way to avoid it. We are experiencing global average temperature now that results from actions in the past. The future is already locked in at some level, and we can take individual actions to try to make the situation better. But at some level, we have already triggered all those self-reinforcing feedback loops we've been talking about: permafrost, loss of albedo, methane release from the Arctic Ocean, on and on the list goes. There's no stopping them now. The genie's out of the bottle.
So you figure that we have about 10 years before we're in a cataclysmic environment?
I think we have as little as 18 months before we're in a cataclysmic environment based on loss of Arctic ice, or essentially loss of Arctic ice, less than a million square kilometers, and the subsequent release of methane. That could happen very easily this summer and lead to major crop failure throughout the globe, major crop failure next spring and summer. So I'm not talking about a situation that's going to manifest 10 years down the road. We could easily be facing a situation within 18 months where we are locked in a daily struggle for our lives, even here in the relatively privileged, quote, first world nations.
Guy McPherson, thank you very much. From the jungles of Belize, from being on today, even though we had some technical difficulties, I appreciate you sharing your thoughts with us.
No problem, Gary. I appreciate the opportunity to chat, and it seems that people are getting hacked every time I do an interview now, so I guess this shouldn't surprise me.
No, we suspected it could happen, and it has on other shows. All the best to you.
Thank you, and to you.
I'd like to share some of my own thoughts. I am never a fatalist. I do not believe in nihilism, and the reason is simple, because every single day, 7 days a week, I am faced with meeting people whose doctors told them they have a week, a month, 6 months to live, and it's over. They tried everything that was supposed to work, nothing worked, and so they're told to go home and put their life in order and take their morphine and wait out until the passing with as little pain as possible. Well, in my world, there's always possible, and a lot of those people are alive and well today because we became creative. We shifted the nature of the energy from negative to positive and absolutely started to disconnect everything that could have led to disease. I'm one of those people who believe that a lot of people can handle the truth, but most people cannot, because most people right now cannot handle the truth. If we could handle the truth, we would never vote for either a Democrat or a Republican. We would look for the independent, and we would hold them accountable and look for someone who did not enrich themselves by being in office, but was there to serve the public and nothing more. But we don't have people like that, and the people who've come forward who want to serve the public in any capacity have been roundly rejected by the majority of people. Jill Stein only received 1%, and yet she would have been the most qualified, honest, populist person since Ralph Nader. And yet Nader didn't succeed. Jill Stein didn't succeed. So it's not more truth that we need. It is a different way of knowing, a different way of feeling, a different way of believing that something is doable, possible. But it is not for our government. Our government will not change. Our industries will not change. Our states and governors and the people in those legislators will not change. There's too much at risk to tell the full truth. Also, we must understand that what one person believes to be a truth may not be universally shared, and it may not be that because of all the different information we have that the timetable is that quick. It may be 20 years. It could be as short as 10 years. And it starts and then it accelerates. We see that with someone who's one day they wake up and they're fine. And then later that day there's a tornado and they're no longer fine. They no longer have a home. And we always wonder, how did that happen? Why does it happen? Where does it happen? Can we move out of harm's way? And rarely do people move out of harm's way. They just simply try to bear it the next time around. From a scientific perspective, it is impossible to make clear, accurate prognosis or predictions about an endpoint to climate change, nor is there sufficient information to accurately determine, without question, the pace of global warming or the utter collapse of Western civilization as we know it, or the extinction of our species. In spite of the fact that 200 species are being eliminated, as Guy McPherson said, every single 24 hours, but when was that ever up on anyone's to-do list? It's as if we don't care. We don't care about the human species. We only care about ourselves. Therefore, there will not be a unifying principle to bring people together. We have passed that point of putting in a Marshall Plan on the environment. We could. It would make a tremendous difference if everyone stopped eating meat, if everyone stopped getting plastic, if everyone stopped buying stuff they didn't need, if we put in a national transportation system with high-speed trains, low pollution. They exist now. Germany has one. But we won't. We'll only do something where it's very profitable to a small group of people, and then, based upon their interconnected relationships with politicians, then it becomes possible. It is certain that climate change predictions publicly made available by the conventional climatological community are way too conservative. This observation has been stated and elaborated upon by Michael Mann, a colleague of James Hansen at Columbia University's Earth Institute. The media and politicians like good news stories, happy endings, everything is going to be all right, and more than not, will always twist, distort, and stretch the bad into something either mild or hopeful. How many believe that it is possible for humanity, through our genius and technological innovations, to keep the temperature at 2 degrees Celsius, thereby convincing us that everything will be fine for ourselves in the future? We just need another conference in 4 years, another meeting of scientists, happy days. Sorry, it's not going to work that way. Yet the conundrum occurs when worst-case scenarios are framed as absolute predictions rather than the sole opinion of an individual's analysis. Paraphrasing a great Sufi saint of the past, spiritual truth is a trumpet blast for those whose time to come to awakening, and a lullaby for those who still need to sleep. Unless a person is fully enlightened, truth-funded upon the rules of cause and effect is always relative. The Buddha stated this repeatedly, and quantum physicists recognize this as a fundamental fact in our universe. This is essential. And the ethical question, therefore, is what degrees does a relative hard truth about climate change become a means to destroy all hope in people? Hope certainly has its downsides. People can live hoping for something to improve their entire lives, simply waiting, and nothing happens. I'm one of those people who believe in being proactive. As such, in my own life, I have begun that process. In fact, it is well along in creating an environment that is 100% sustainable. I do not fear the future because societies do not collapse all at once, all in one place. It begins in places that we think are non-essential. And then it begins in places within our own country. As long as you have quality water, as long as you have good soil, as long as you have good hydroponics, as long as you have a good community, there's no reason to be pessimistic, nihilistic. And there are enough people who are aware that they can do something who will begin to. For those who wait in their shelter of their homes and their offices, not believing any of this until it hits. Remember Katrina. They watched it coming for 5 days on television, over the internet, until we were watching them up on the roof saying, "Help us." And that's unfortunate. But we are a community, a world community of watching Katrina. And as far as starvation, we have 16.8 million children in the United States, as I speak today, who are food insecure, who go to bed hungry each night. And we can't even have a march, a protest. We can't even have an editorial on their behalf. What does that say about us and the community of spiritual souls caring about other spiritual souls? I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day. War is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate.